WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nicolas Cage, an actor famous for his riveting performances and his obsessive preparation. He starred in action films like Face Off, Con Air, and The Rock, comedies like Moonstruck and Raising Arizona, film noir like Red Rock West, and emotionally complex dramas like Leaving Las Vegas, for which he won an Oscar. His new World War II film, Wind Talkers, opens tomorrow. It's set in the Pacific island of Saipan, where tactical battlefield messages are being radioed through a new secret code using the Navajo language. Navajo Marines are the code talkers and translators. Cage plays a tough Marine who is assigned to protect one of these Navajo code talkers. But if the code talker falls into enemy hands, Cage is expected to kill the code talker so that he can't reveal the code under torture. In this early scene, Cage is keeping his emotional distance from the new Navajo soldier he is protecting, who hasn't yet proven himself in battle and strikes Cage as a little naive. The code talker is played by Adam Beach.
What are you doing here?
Trying to help.
Not what I meant.
You mean, what am I doing in this uniform? It's my war too, Sergeant. I'm fighting for my country, for my land, for my people.
Not your people I'm worried about.
Listen, Enders, I'm a code talker. It takes me 2.5 minutes to do what used to take an hour. Now, somebody wearing a lot more stripes than you thinks that's worth something.
Remind me to tell me when you got bullets flying over your head.
What the hell's wrong with you?
Wind Talkers was directed by John Woo, who also directed Cage in Face Off. Wu suggested that Cage watch the war film Guns of Navarone. I asked Cage what other films he watched in preparation.
There was one with Richard Widmark. I think it was called The Halls of Montezuma, and his performance in that I found very interesting. He was eating aspirin a lot in the film, and so I like the idea of characters who are going through some kind of either physical or emotional or mental instability, so I introduced the idea of the painkiller for Joe Enders as well because of Widmark's performance in that.
No, you're taking painkillers because in the first scene of the movie you're injured.
Yeah,
it's an injury that affects your ear and your hearing and your sense of balance as well.
Yes, my equilibrium is off.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about staging the war scenes. You're directed by John Woo in this, and he's a terrific director and really has a gift for action and for depicting violence as well. I mean, he really knows how to stage that. Maybe you can take one of the battle sequences, maybe even the opening sequence, and describe a little bit about what happened on your end behind the scenes, the kind of advice who gave you, if any, and what's going on around you?
Well, the first battle sequence, not the first one in the movie, but with the whole team of men that we grow to know through the film. I think it's the invasion of Saipan. There must have been about 280 bombs that were set. There were about 14 cameras that were going at all times. There must have been, I don't know, 170 men, atmosphere as well as the actors. Some of them were actual Marines. And you would go through this whole sort of rehearsal process where you have to find out your marks, which is to say where you're supposed to land and where you're supposed to move to and make sure you're going to be on camera when you're doing it and make sure you don't hurt anybody else because even though they're blanks, they're still dangerous, so the guns can't be pointed in the other people's faces. It wasn't until, I'd say, the last hour or two of the day that we actually started photographing because the shots were so intricate. And the main thing I was concerned about is that I just didn't want to blow it. I didn't want to miss my mark. I didn't want to forget my lines, you know, because if I did, then that meant they had to go all the way back to the beginning again and reset all the bombs, and I didn't want to wear that. So that was what really kept me on my toes.
So give me a sense of the choreography. This isn't stuff that's going to be like in a script. It's not dialogue.
Yeah, we would just go over and over it. I mean, there was one sequence where I remember I had to run, but be ahead of all the bullet hits that were going off, because otherwise, you know, some of the wood or the gunpowder or whatever could get in my eyes. And so it really, I mean, it's kind of hard to describe. It's very methodical. It's, you know, okay, you're going to run through here. You're going to stop at this point. You're going to put down your weapon because you're out of bullets. Reload another find another weapon, pick that up, and sort of spin around and stab this guy and shoot. It was a very physical shoot. And I remember once there was a bomb that went off, and I think John, who sometimes likes to surprise his actors by making the bombs bigger than we were told they were. You know, a bomb went off and I walked into the fire by accident because the wind shifted, and it actually did burn me. And then I was torn with this sort of conundrum of having to either do my job and keep moving forward or back off and not get burned. And I think I went and moved forward, and then John had to call cut, 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 because he didn't want me to get burned. But you know, it sounds a lot scarier than it is, because at the time that I was doing it, I just kept thinking, my God, you know, I'm just an actor. And there were people that really had to go through this for real. And I would play jokes with myself thinking, you know, what would it be like if the director just said, all right, we're using real bullets now and real bombs, and here we go, action.
Even with the blanks and stuff, do you ever feel, this isn't exactly what I signed up for. I didn't sign up for being bombed and shot at and having to stab people.
Well,
when I said sign up for it, I meant like when you became an actor. You know, did you? Yeah.
No, I imagine I was going to do a little bit of everything.
Right. Do you think you've been in a lot of action films? Do you think that John Woo handles action any differently than other directors who you've worked with?
Well, I think that what makes John Woo singular is that he's, in my opinion, a musician. His background in ballroom dancing and, you know, his love of music is really in the movies. I mean, I asked him point blank, do your camera moves have anything to do with the ballroom dance? And he said, absolutely. Even when the guns go off, it's like, you know, the bullets are almost like notes that are percussion that sort of complement the expressions of his actors. You know, Face Off, for example, was operatic. The other thing is that his connection with his actors is quite unique. He likes to dance in a place of extremes, and so do I. So we sort of understand one another. And he's not afraid to go into a scene without a great deal of planning. And when I say that, it sounds uncharacteristic of what we just talked about. But what I mean to say is, sometimes 5 minutes before the shot, I don't know what I'm going to do, and he doesn't know what I'm going to do. And so he'll put several cameras on it, just in case a surprise happens that he likes. And this makes for a very spontaneous kind of acting. It makes for a sort of an electric kind of performance. And, you know, it doesn't mean it's always going to work. And a lot of what I did didn't work and didn't make it in the movie. But what you see is what he selected. So I feel safe with him. But I think he's that way with all actors. And that's why you get very unique performances from a John Woo movie. And that's also why his action films are different from other action films.
Woo has a kind of signature shot of two men standing a few feet opposite each other, each with a gun pointed on the other. And that shot seems to show up in at least all the films of his I've seen. And there's a shot like that in Wind Talkers, too.
It's interesting about John because he's a devout Christian and he hates guns. So when you think about that, it's just kind of interesting, the sort of the dichotomy in the man.
Well, that's a perfect shot for that, because when two guys are standing from away, a few feet away from each other, each having a gun pointed on the other, it is a kind of futility, violence kind of scene, because everyone's going to die.
Yeah. It is a pretty bleak picture in that regard, but I think what I find very stirring is sort of the spiritual aspect of the film. And when I asked Albert Smith, who was one of the actual co-talkers on the set, how he got through it, he said the way he got through it was because of his faith. And I think that's also a signature of John Woo. There's always some sort of reference to a church in his films. I know in Face Off there was, and also in Wind Talkers, my character Joe Enders is drawing a church in some flower. So there is, even though there's all this death, there's also the notion of you know, being closer to God.
Do you ever wish you could have that kind of faith too? Maybe you have it. Maybe I'm making an assumption.
No, I do have faith. I believe in God, and I am a Christian.
A lot of the movie is about how your character is constantly looking death in the face, your own death, and the death of the men that you're fighting with. You've watched your own death time and time again in movies. Does it put you in touch with the inevitability of your own death? I mean, do you take it personally when you see yourself die in a movie?
Well, I see it very much as a performance. My own feelings about death are almost Japanese in thinking. You know, there is a samurai philosophy that you have to earn your right to die. Death has always been sort of a friend to me because I've never ignored the fact that it's going to happen. I'm very accepting of it. And so since I know it's going to happen, it's always been something that I wear on my shoulder that says, you know, get to work because you only have so much time. You know, try to really live your life to its fullest and maximize your day in every way that you can, get the most out of it. You know, wherever it is that we do go, you know, you kind of earn your right to go there by how hard you've worked or how much you've appreciated life.
Is that an attitude you've worked on or one that just came naturally to you?
It started when I was about 15. I remember that I didn't really believe in... at that time, I didn't really believe in heaven or hell. I did believe in death, and so I kind of made a vow to myself that if I could achieve these goals in my life, that I would be okay with my death. Now I've since changed my views, but somewhat. But I don't see death as a horrible thing. I you know, there's a 50% chance it could be really amazing, and because no one really knows what it is. And the only thing I know that's kind of weird. I mean, as long as we're on the subject, you know, I had to, you know, go through my will the other day with my attorney and all that, and you know, what is it that you want? If God forbid you're in a car accident, do you want to go and be in a coma, or do you want them to pull the plug? And I'm like, God, I gotta think about this now. But I said, well, you know, I hear coma is not a bad place, so maybe not. But what I do know is that I don't want to be bombed out of my skull on some like massive dose of morphine. If I go into the next life, I want to go in aware. If there is a next life, I'd like to be aware. So I had them write that down.
Don't you think though you might want the pain dulled if?
Yeah, I mean that's the tricky part is that I see these. Remember those? They were Buddhists, weren't they? That did that activist
set themselves on fire.
Yeah.
During the Vietnam War.
Get to? Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do they get to that point to be that in control of their state that to not even flinch when they're burning to death? And I think it's a life's work to actually prepare yourself for the moment of death.
Is this all connected to acting too, the way you handle it? Do you see acting as almost an altered state or a kind of act of willed consciousness?
I'm starting to change even my views on acting. It's mm-hmm. it's strange. I mean, I do see it as an altered state. I think that's a good way of putting it. As crazy as it sounds, I almost see it like channeling spirits. You know, I once heard Jimi Hendrix talk about energies and how you can gather those things together. You know, with a little dog hair or I don't know what he was talking about in his boot. And I've been using that almost in some of my interviews. That's my new method. That I put wild dog hair in my boot and give gifts to the spirits. But it was more done in jest, but the truth of the matter is, you know, if they are out there, I would be interested in trying to incorporate that in some way into my acting.
My guest is Nicolas Cage. He's starring in the new World War II film Wind Talkers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Nicolas Cage is my guest, and he's starring in the new World War II movie Wind Talkers, which is directed by John Woo. There's at least two, like, different threads of your career, one the more action-oriented roles and the other the more introspective roles, like Leaving Las Vegas or Red Rock West. I'm wondering if you ever expected to become an action hero when you started acting, if you were ever even physical in that kind of way or athletic when you were young.
I was probably the last person on the list for starring in an action movie. And it was, even though I wanted to, because I always liked action films as a boy. And I had heroes like Clint Eastwood and Sean Connery, who I was lucky to work with in The Rock. And, you know, I always saw it as escapist entertainment, which to me is cogent. It's just as valuable as the thought-provoking and introspective work that actors do in art films or indie films, because to be honest with you, there are times when I don't want to have to think. I just want to go and get my mind off my problems or whatever it is and have my popcorn and escape. And but to answer your question, I was not someone who was perceived as action material. And then it was, I guess, Jerry Bruckheimer who cast me in The Rock. But even so, I was playing a nerd in the beginning of that movie who then becomes an action hero. But I thought there was a world stage there, which action is. I was trying to build my foreign market up, and I thought more people would see the work. And I thought, well, why not try to do something? Just because it's a genre picture doesn't mean you can't create a character. So I was trying to dig a little deeper, even with the action material. And what I found was that I had to be very quick on my feet and very succinct about what it is I wanted to say, because it is formula, and as long as it propels the plot, the plot of the film, you can get away with it, but it can be very, very brief. And it's almost like they want to get to the car chase or get to the explosion. So whatever acting you want to do, you got to do it fast, which is frustrating, but it's also good training, because it does sort of distill you down to the precise essence of the character, so to speak. And so, but having said that, I am happy to get back to, the independent movies. I just work with Spike Jonze on adaptation, and did Bringing Out the Dead with Martin Scorsese, and so I feel like I've mixed it up still. It's just because action is such a huge genre, it's so popular, more people actually think I've made action films than the first 15 years of my career, which was mostly sort of intense character studies in indie films and then also romantic comedies.
Mm-hmm, right, right. Well, since becoming an action hero, you have had to really change your body, pump up a lot. Has it changed your sense of self physically?
Well, no. The truth of the matter is that I've always been physical. I've always worked out. I started working out when I was 12 years old.
What motivated you to do that when you were 12? Not that you need any big reason, but
yeah, no. Well, I am thinking about it. I guess I wanted to look better. I wanted to feel stronger. And then I found that I got almost kind of addicted to it. It became a place where I could put my anger. You know, as a young boy growing up, I had a lot of anger that was needed to be directed or focused, and working out helped me with that. To this day, I've used exercise as a place to sort of clear my head and relax. Usually, it's like the endorphins build up, and I feel better. It's more of a mental thing than anything else for me. Although, I do prefer to look trim.
Nicolas Cage is starring in the new World War II film Windtalkers. It opens tomorrow. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nicolas Cage. His new movie, Windtalkers, opens tomorrow. It's set on the Pacific island of Saipan during World War II. Cage's other films include The Rock, Con Air, Leaving Las Vegas, Red Rock West, Raising Arizona, and Moonstruck. I want to ask you about Face Off, which is a really great and also really funny in its own way action film that you starred in with John Travolta, that was directed by John Woo, who directed your new movie. And in this movie, you're a sadistic criminal. John Travolta is an FBI agent on your trail. And for reasons really too complicated to explain here, Travolta is given a replica of your face through cosmetic surgery so he can go undercover and infiltrate your network. But then you, the villain, manage to get cosmetic surgery on your face so that you can look like Travolta, thwart his plan, and also gain intimate access to his family. So it's really an acting fest because, you know, you're playing the personality of John Travolta's character and he's playing yours, and you're imitating each other's mannerisms. And it must have been so much fun to do in that respect, to work with Travolta and he with you, and to have to copy each other's mannerisms and use that within the performance.
It was, and there were a lot of times when we were like two kids in a classroom saying, "Are we in trouble yet?" Because we were really having a lot of fun with it and pushing it to the limits with that one. But just hearing you describe what Face Off is about, it sounds so complex, doesn't it? It's like a Rubik's Cube or something. It's the layers upon layers of what that plot was about is it was a little bit of a puzzle. You know, it was like putting together a puzzle. And whereas I did actually start the movie as the killer for the first 10 or 12 minutes, and that part was a lot of fun to play. I actually play Sean Archer, the part that John Travolta developed in the first 12 or 15 minutes, for the whole length of the film from that point on. So he then got to be the bad guy with all the flashy moves and attitude, and then I had to become his character, which was the more of the emotional and heartfelt character in the movie. And you know, John Travolta is he's a superstar, but his idiosyncrasies are very subtle, and it was rather hard for me to grasp his vocalizations and his mannerisms. So I mean, what we would do sometimes is get tapes of the dailies, so I would be watching him in the movie and try to copy some of his mannerisms, and then I also would go back and look at some of his older films and try to study it. But his impression of me is pretty impeccable. He did it at the American Cinematheque, and on a videotape where he's pretending like he's me, and he still does it, and it brought the house down. People just think it's hilarious.
What did he pick up on you?
Well, I think he picked up the way I tend to elongate my words when I talk, you know, that sort of like there's a glass object that I'm really interested in buying today, John.
And did you know that you did that, or did it make yourself conscious to hear him doing you?
Well, I didn't know that I did that, actually. But now I do. So now when I hear myself, I'm thinking, my God, am I becoming a caricature of myself, you know?
Is that a kind of self-consciousness that's potentially dangerous?
I don't know that it is dangerous. I mean, you know, when I first started acting, I felt that my voice was not interesting at all. And it occurred to me that all the great actors whom I loved were stars that had voices that are imitable. And, you know, like Bogart or Cagney or Brando or Eastwood, these are all people that have voices you can imitate. And it's fun to be able to imitate them. So I worked very hard on trying to understand what was distinctive about my voice and try to accentuate it. But at first, I was doing everything I could not to use my voice. I would even in Peggy Sue Got Married, I used the voice of I think it was Pokey from the Gumby show. I mean, which was really a stretch. But so I've always believed that voice and the actor are important together.
One thing I find interesting about your voice is that it's on the one hand very kind of colloquial sounding, and on the other hand, you have this impeccable pronunciation.
No, thank you.
You know, so it's an odd mix of things.
Well, my father is a literature professor, and I remember, you know, he always spoke with this kind of distinction in his voice, and I guess that was a choice for him. He told me that once, that he... because he's a literature professor, that he wanted to speak with distinction and to speak accurately with proper English. And so I guess I'm sort of an amalgamation of my father and also just this kid that grew up in Long Beach, California, you know, surrounded by, you know, people that did not speak with distinction. So it's sort of a combination of things,
right.
I guess.
Now, getting back to Face Off, you said it was hard to find distinctive things about Travolta to pick up on in your impression
of him
in the movie.
It wasn't that it was hard to find them, because he is distinctive, he is unique, and but it's just that his are very subtle. So I had to had to try to find ways of not overdoing it. I had to try to pick up on his subtleties. You know, he's a very facile and smooth a performer, whereas I think my traits can get a little kind of edgy and bigger. You know, I can sometimes get, people use the word over the top, but that for me is not really a criticism, even though they mean it as a criticism. For me, it's just a place that I like to go as a style. It's a stylistic thing.
So what did you pick up on Travolta?
Well, he just sometimes he gets this this mannerism in his voice where it's like almost like a hurt little boy, and it, you know, and he is, and the look gets in his eyes, and also there's a little bit of a sort of a stutter there that comes in, and you know, and I really, is how you doing, Nick? Is everything good? That's, you know, like that. And I had to sort of bring that into the character.
My guest is Nicolas Cage. Here he is in a scene from Face Off toward the end of the film when he and John Travolta are face to face trying to kill each other.
I don't know what I hate wearing worse, your face or your body. I mean, I enjoy boning your wife, but well, let's face it, we both like it better the other way, yes? So why don't we just trade back?
You can't give back what you've taken from me.
Oh, well. Plan B. Let's just kill each other.
We'll talk more with Nicolas Cage after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicolas Cage. He won an Academy Award for his performance in Leaving Las Vegas as a man who has decided to drink himself to death. He falls in love with a beautiful prostitute, but that's not going to stop him from reaching his goal. The prostitute is played by Elizabeth Shue. Here's a scene shortly after they meet. They're in bed, drinking and talking.
So, Ben, with an N, brings you to Las Vegas. Business convention?
No. I came here to drink myself to death. Cashed in all my money, paid my Amex card. I'm gonna sell the car tomorrow.
So, how long is it gonna take for you to drink yourself to death?
I think about 4 weeks. I don't know for sure, but I think I got enough for about $250, $300 a day.
That should do it. What am I? A luxury?
Yes. You're a luxury, and your meter just ran out.
It's a nice watch.
You do like it?
Yes. You can talk a little bit more. I don't have to be anywhere. Come on, talk.
Well, in L.A., I kept running out of booze, and the store would be closed because I forget to look at my watch.
Leaving Las Vegas was based on a story by a writer who was so depressed he killed himself before the movie was made. I asked Cage if he could comprehend that level of depression.
Well, I made a choice early on in the rehearsal process that I wasn't going to play him depressed because I always felt that there's nothing sadder than a person who's in a sad situation than a person who's in a sad situation and doesn't know it. So consequently, I thought that Ben Sanderson, even though the truth is he is so depressed that he's going to drink himself to death, on the surface, he had freed himself and he would be smiling a lot and laughing a lot and I thought that would make it even more, sad. And the idea there was that, if someone isn't holding on to life anymore, and I compared it to like a man who's not struggling in the river, he's not trying to hold on to branches anymore. He's not trying to stay afloat. He's let go, and he's very relaxed, and he's floating down the river. And that's how I saw Ben. I saw him as somebody who had let go and was not afraid to die, and therefore he could do anything. And he was going to have 4 weeks to do it, and he was going to have one big party. And he was responsible about it. He cashed out. He cleared his debts. And he wasn't going to be a burden to anybody anymore. He wasn't going to be a burden to his boss. He feels bad that he upset his boss. I got the idea that he was an elegant man at one point, so that went into the costumes. The only thing I did do with Ben was I remember at one point Mike Figgis wanted me to drive a Jaguar, which was, I think, a really good idea, actually, an older Jaguar, because that would fall into the notion of his elegance. But I said, no, I think he should drive a BMW like every other agent in town. So we went with the BMW, and what was curious about that, if you talk about channeling, is that O'Brien, John O'Brien, who wrote the book and who actually did commit suicide, his automobile vehicle of choice was a BMW. And also, apparently, I wore the same watches as John. I didn't know that. And when the family came to visit us on the set, they said they were stunned at some of the moves that were coming out of me because they were so much like John's. And so that's sort of what got me to thinking about all that. But to answer your question, I didn't play him depressed.
I read that your mother was depressive, that she suffered from depression. And I don't know whether she was the kind of wisecracking depressive that your character is in Leaving Las Vegas. My guess is that she wasn't. And I'm wondering if your knowledge of her depression informed your performance in any way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it did. I think there are moments in the movie where I watch and I go, wow, that's Mom, you know. But these are things that happen sort of almost by accident or by spontaneity. I don't think about it. You know, it's sort of on me that way. But she was a good mother. I mean, she still is, and she isn't going through the same things that she was when I was a kid. But it's impossible for it not to affect me artistically on some level.
You had to be drunk for a lot. Your character had to be drunk for a lot of Leaving Las Vegas. There's a lot of very cliched ways of playing a drunk person. We've all seen the cliches. What did you do to try to play the way you thought this character would be drunk? And I'm wondering if you drank a lot yourself while preparing for the role just to kind of get a sense of mechanically what goes on when you've had a lot to drink.
Well, for one thing, I did look at a lot of movies dealing with that subject matter. And let's see, I looked at Lemon in Days of Wine and Roses and Milan in The Lost Weekend and Dudley Moore in Arthur and... they were all excellent performances, and some for different reasons. Dudley Moore in that movie, because he was really good with the sound level. Like when people get drunk, they start talking much louder, and he would do that in the film, and he hit on that. But I think the performance that affected me the most, where I said that person's not acting, that person's really drunk, was. Albert Finney in Under the Volcano, and he is such a fine actor, I'll never really know, but I was convinced that when he's walking through those streets with his sunglasses on and his tux, that he was drunk. But I think Mike Figgis even asked him about it. He said, no, you know, you tell Nick that I wasn't. I just I would sip something to get a sense of the taste, and then I would spit it out. So I think I went with Albert's sort of model, really, but I would, in fact, drink on a couple scenes in that movie because I wanted it to be extremely real. And I remember I would drink on my own and then videotape it, me getting drunk so that I could see what I was like. And then I destroyed the videotape, but I would use that as a way to get into the character. But there was one scene in the casino where I freak out and I sort of smash the table and break a glass and start shouting that I was completely inebriated, and so much so that I had to. Crawl to my room after I had done the scene, and I don't think I ever made it into my hotel room. I actually fell asleep outside the door, woke up in the morning in the hallway. But the reason why I did that, and I don't recommend it for actors if that's what they, you know, were hearing me go, well, I'll try that. I mean, I don't know how healthy it is, but I was experimenting with the idea of being out of control in art, and being in control while being out of control is sort of the goal, you know? So I said, well, this scene, I don't have a lot of dialogue, and I'm going to go out of control here. I want to go out of control here. I want to create that kind of connection with the audience where they're really they feel like there's some danger in the room, and I want them to freak out with me. So that's why I did it.
And how does it look to you when you watch it?
It's very painful. It looks painful to me. It is real, you know. So I feel like I achieved that, but I don't watch it that often, to be honest with you.
Was the director Mike Figgis disturbed when he saw how drunk you were? Did he know what you were up to?
He was a part of the process the whole time. I mean, he knew that I was going to go there. I let him know,
right,
and he concurred.
My guest is Nicolas Cage. He's now starring in the new World War II film, Wind Talkers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicolas Cage. He's starring in the new World War II movie, Wind Talkers. How did you know as a child that you wanted to act?
I was 6 years old. I was sitting on the living room carpet watching our old round, oval-shaped Zenith TV. And I just remember I wanted to be inside that TV so bad. I just wanted to get out of there and get in that TV. And I think that's my first real cognizant recollection of wanting to act, that I wanted to, I couldn't understand how people got inside the television set, and I wanted to go there.
And then when you grew up a little bit and started to watch a lot of movies and TV shows, who were some of the actors who really did it for you?
Well, my favorite television actor was Bill Bixby. He and the movie, the TV series, The Courtship of Eddie's Father, was one of my favorite shows, and I would watch that as a boy. But he was also great in My Favorite Martian. So I always thought Bixby was a fine performer, and I think even now in some of my work, you can sort of see his influence a little bit. I was talking with a friend of mine a few years back, Crispin Glover, and he was saying he could see some of that, even though I'm not aware of it. I'm certainly not doing that, but I guess it just happened naturally. But the other thing I discovered later was James Dean in East of Eden and also Rebel Without a Cause. I was 15, and that really put the hook in me to become an actor.
Well, I think that's great that your influences were My Favorite Martian and James Dean.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it shows how young you were when you started being interested in this, that Bill Bixby would have been one of your heroes.
Yeah.
But that wasn't exactly the rebellious, sexy image of James Dean.
Well, no. I mean, what was it? It was James Dean's performance in East of Eden. I responded more to his... I didn't respond to the rebellion or even the sexuality as much as I responded to the pain in him when he tries to give his father the money that he earned by selling beans for his father's birthday. And I guess it was Massey played the dad, and the way he's rejecting him, his body language was just so racked with pain that I... it moved me. I mean, it really got to me more than anything else, any song or painting or any other kind of art form. I knew then that I wanted to be a screen actor.
Now, your uncle is Francis Ford Coppola, so I'm wondering if you had access to films that you otherwise might not have seen, if your uncle ever screened movies for you or suggested movies for you that you might not otherwise have known about.
Well, I remember being at his house and him playing movies from time to time. Michael Powell films, I remember him playing.
Mm-hmm.
The what was the name of that movie?
Black Narcissus.
The Peeping Tom.
Yeah.
You know, that had a big impact on me. And my father too. He was always projecting movies at home, and that's really where I began my interest in German Expressionism, was because my father was playing Nosferatu, at the house, and I remember it affecting me and giving me nightmares, even though I'm watching this sort of, you know, silent black and white movie. I was really creeped out by Max Schreck's performance, and it stayed with me. And I think the movie that really freaked me out was The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and my father played that for me, and it left an indelible impression, and that, of course, later went on to affect my producing Shadow of the Vampire. So that's why that movie came together.
Well, Nicolas Cage, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Nicolas Cage is starring in the new World War II film Wind Talkers, directed by John Woo. It opens tomorrow.